Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The Western United States continues to experience massive wildfires, and there's little reassurance that that will change in the immediacy. The Mosquito Fire in Placer and El Dorado counties has burned over 76,000 acres and currently stands as the largest wildfire so far this year in California. It's also another example of a wildfire capable of creating its own weather, from pyrocumulus clouds to lightning and thunder. Those pyrocumulus clouds particularly are becoming more common and can impact air quality drastically. Kai Wilton is a postdoctoral researcher from the University of Utah who worked on a recently published report that shines a light on the effects of wildfire plumes on air quality. Thanks for joining us, Kai.
Yeah, happy to be here.
So your recent research about wildfire plumes in the Western United States, it focuses on the impacts of aerosol injections into the troposphere, which is the lowest layer of atmosphere. What happens here that was at most interest to you?
I guess what we were looking at was trends in wildfire plume top heights, or basically just how the altitude at which the smoke is being injected into the atmosphere. And so generally what we're seeing is that across the mountainous western U.S., and in particular in portions of California, that there's trends towards higher plume top heights. So these plumes are getting larger.
What exactly are aerosol injections?
So aerosols are going to be like tiny particles in the atmosphere, extremely fine. They can penetrate deep into the human lungs. That's why we're concerned about them. And by injection, we're just talking about sort of the altitude at which they are emitted into the atmosphere. So this wildfire plume sort of injects these aerosols vertically into the atmosphere. And then at some point, they sort of settle in and begin flowing downwind. So we're looking for the altitude at which that kind of transition takes place.
Especially in recent years, when it comes to wildfires impacting air quality, that has become like a shared lived experience in California. You don't even have to be near a wildfire to experience it. When it comes to, so there's been growing conversations about this in recent years, as at the point that I'm getting to. Can you tell us what inspired this specific research and why it's so important today?
A lot of the work that we're doing is kind of based on this idea that, again, many of the people in the West will understand, is that there's trends towards air quality degradation across the West as a result of wildfire activity. And this is becoming increasingly regional. And so we've looked at trends in smoke at the surface. We're performing additional model analyses for this. But as a component to that, we need to understand sort of the altitude at which this smoke is being emitted into the atmosphere. That's an important component because it's going to dictate the direction, speed that this smoke is transported downwind, and then also kind of how thick that smoke is in particular areas. So it's an important piece of the puzzle here.
So the higher it travels up in altitude, does it become more concerning?
I would say generally, yes. I mean, the big picture idea here is that smoke that is emitted higher in the atmosphere is going to be transported downwind more efficiently. So it increases the probability of air quality concerns at a further distance from the fire. Essentially, these fires can have more of a regional air quality impact as opposed to some more local impact on air quality.
What did you learn from your findings that surprised you?
I think maybe the most staggering piece is really just how much the 2015 to 2020 data points stand out compared to the rest of our time series. So we're looking at 2003 to 2020. You know, just intuitively from living in the West, we had this sense that, you know, the last few years seem like they've been a bit different. So I kind of expected them to stand out. But I mean, 2020 is just staggering compared to the rest of the time series. So I don't know. Very concerning.
Yeah. You know, we're currently in Northern California. We're dealing with the Mosquito Fire, which is the largest wildfire so far this year in California. And with that wildfire, we dealt with the formation of a massive pyrocumulus cloud. How do these clouds form?
So essentially what we need is some moisture higher in the atmospheric column. So heat released at the site of the fire is going to generate this plume. As that air rises, eventually it gets to the point where the moisture in that air can begin to condense. And so then we start forming cloud within the plume. And then due to that condensation, as we form cloud, latent heat, or heat that's contained within that moisture, is released. And so the plume can continue to rise. And so that's how we get these really large plumes. Essentially, they're able to tap into atmospheric moisture to grow larger.
Mm. And with those plumes comes aerosol particles that get shot up into the air.
So, I mean, for any fire, really, we're going to have aerosol particles that are emitted into the atmosphere. But in these cases, we're seeing particles that are getting to, much greater heights, essentially.
So they're great. They're affecting the air quality in a greater quantity?
I would say yes. On average, that's probably a good way to state it.
I'm just curious. Your research is extensive. How do you measure aerosol injections and analyze all this data?
Yeah, so that's a pretty challenging aspect. Essentially, we have to slice this a number of different ways. So we're looking at, what's the maximum height that we see associated with the plume? You can measure it that way. At what altitudes is most of the aerosol mass associated with that plume kind of being emitted into the atmosphere? So you can kind of track that vertical distribution of emissions. So are we seeing more emission towards the top of the plume, more emission towards the bottom of the plume, things like that? So there's kind of a number of different measures. But with reference to this research, essentially what we found is kind of the same story across those measures. Plumes are getting taller and emitting more smoke higher in the atmosphere.
Ultimately, what does this mean for the long-term air quality across the Western United States?
I think the big picture is that, we have strong reason to believe that these trends are fueled by climate-related trends to decreasing snowpack, increasing atmospheric aridity and temperatures. And kind of given the projection for those trends into the future, there's a pretty reasonable expectation that we're going to continue to see these plumes increase in height. So essentially, the outlook for air quality across the West is pretty bleak. We can expect this to likely get worse into the future.
I guess you foresee that instead of like snow days, we're going to be needing bad air quality stay-at-home days as a precaution for our health?
That's definitely a concern, especially, for places that happen to be near the fires where it can get, exceptionally bad. But the regional outlook is also concerning. It's hard to pin down exactly how bad we expect it to get. But if we extrapolate these trends into the future, again, it's not looking good.
Yeah. I mean, although this isn't always the case, but in a lot of instances, these wildfires are occurring across terrain, mountainous terrain across the Western United States, especially from that period that you were looking at from 2003 to 2020. Is there something unique about the terrain of mountain ranges when it comes to contributing to rising fire plumes?
The mountainous terrain plays a few roles. One, it's just harder to combat fires that are in mountainous terrain. It's harder to access those fires. And then in addition to that, kind of this complex terrain can actually enhance the fire spread in some ways. So, for instance, the fire, if it's on a hillside, can sort of pre-dry the fuels that it's about to move into. So it can sort of set itself up for future success. So the mountainous terrain plays a few roles there.
When government agencies or scientists look at this research, how can they use it to find solutions to mitigate bad air quality?
That one's a little challenging. I mean, at this point in time, I think what we have is a sense of kind of roughly when and where we can expect air quality to be impacted. So what months, what locations roughly? So maybe we can start planning ahead for how to deal with those sorts of issues. As far as directly addressing this, again, in the short term, there's not a lot of, great solutions for that. There's no silver bullet for this problem, right? Like we have some combination of, trying to avoid human ignited fires, fire suppression in particular cases, along urban areas, et cetera. But in the long term, we're going to need kind of a multi-pronged approach that includes, some forest management techniques and ideally addressing, the components that are leading to these underlying changes in terms of atmospheric aridity, temperatures, et cetera. Like, it's a climate problem on some level.
Yeah, and those conversations are very layered and nuanced and widespread, and we're talking about just one component of this. Finally, Kai, I'm curious, this is research that really affects everyone. We're all impacted by air quality, right? Like, we all breathe. When you leave your research and you go talk to, you know, your family or your friends or just the community, what message do you want them to take away from your work?
I think the big picture there again is that unfortunately we can kind of expect this to get worse into the future. And particularly for friends and family, I try to emphasize, you know, that this air quality really is poor for your health. I feel like, you know, it's pretty easy to know that, but also write it off because you're just so used to going about your day and not dealing with these things. And there's certainly circumstances in which you should be changing your daily routine in accordance with what the air quality is looking like. If it's particularly smoky, you know, maybe don't go for a run, or go to the gym and go for a run. Try to avoid, you know, heavy exercise and these things.
Yeah, I've actually seen someone running in terrible air quality, and it just made me cringe. I was like, don't do that. That's not good for you.
Yeah, yeah, I definitely see that sometimes, and that hurts to see, you know. I'm like, oh, this is not good for you.
Kai, thank you so much for sharing your research.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Kai Wilton is with the University of Utah and worked on a recently published study that shines a light on the effects of wildfire plumes on our air quality. Up next, the American River Basin provides water to millions of people, but a new federal report shows this lifeblood is being threatened by climate change. We'll learn about the challenges in balancing water demands as the Sacramento region continues to grow. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. The Sacramento region is growing. Probably no surprise to you. The Greater Sacramento Economic Council actually has some numbers and reports that it's the fastest growing metro area in the state between 2016 and 2021, and is expected to see even more growth over the next 5 years. A lifeblood of our region is the American River Basin. A watershed spans over 3,600 square miles and provides water to millions of people from Sacramento to Placer and El Dorado counties, as well as Sierra Foothill communities. But a new report released by the Bureau of Reclamation shows that this beloved basin is threatened by climate change. Increased temperatures, a shrinking snowpack, coupled with extreme variability of rain or lack thereof, will increase that dramatic pendulum swings of severe drought and flooding. We're going to spend some time learning more about the challenges of balancing water demands with an uncertain future. Joining us is Gary Bardini, Director of Planning with the Sacramento Area Flood Control Agency, and Kenneth Payne, General Manager of the El Dorado Water Agency. Ken and Gary, welcome to Insight. Good morning.
Good morning, Vicki.
Good morning.
Thanks for having us.
All right, Ken, I want to start with you. You know, as we just mentioned, the American River Basin is beloved. It's also expansive. It stretches east to Sacramento through Gold Country all the way to the western ridges of the Sierra surrounding Tahoe. Can you provide us, just help us visualize better how large and really just how vital this watershed is for the millions of people who depend on it?
Well, the watershed itself, you know, you mentioned it's 3,600 square miles, and it's pretty diverse in its terrain. So you're starting up in the Sierra Nevadas, where there's a lot of forest, so you have a lot of forest, and And as you come down the hill towards the Sacramento River at the other end of the basin, you get into transitions of rural agricultural into the urbanized areas of El Dorado Hills, Folsom, and then all the way down into the city of Sacramento. So we have quite a diverse area that we had to study as part of this market and how things would change or how the impacts from climate change would impact each of these types of areas. So
this study was described by a regional water agency manager as one of the most sophisticated evaluations of climate change impacts on water supplies in California to date. What knowledge was gained from this study that wasn't as clear before, Ken?
Well, we ended up integrating about a half a dozen different models, and a lot of it was new models. And using these models and validating some of the results really took a lot of work with a lot of scientists. I can tell you it was interesting because a lot of these scientists went over my head a lot of times when they were talking about some of their empirical formulas that we were using and how to validate it. But what really came out of it really was when we started seeing the results and validating it with some of the agricultural community of what they were experiencing, some of the urbanized managers downstream. The sophistication of the use of these models had never been done where we integrate not only the climate change models, the temperature changes, but it was the integration of surface water, groundwater modeling, and then adding that to that, the integration of the flood modeling. So it was the first time they are usually done independently. We did this as a comprehensive integrated method, which is why it took quite a bit of time. It was the first study of this kind that was done in California like this.
Right, because it's not like these regions or even these needs exist in vacuums, right? I mean, they're all interconnected.
Right. Oh, very much, yeah. We're within one watershed, and so you look at what happens for if, you know, the temperature changes are even close to being correct from the drier soils up in the forest, and we're seeing that now. All the way down to the urbanized areas of people are going to have to live it a little bit differently on how they landscape their homes and use water internally. So, yeah, it's very diverse. So,
Gary, you're with the Sacramento Area Flood Control Agency. What stood out to you about these findings?
Well, it really kind of continued the show looking in the future that the trend that we're already seeing, that we're seeing more of our runoff come earlier in the season. So typically the snowmelt period is generally in the April through July period. And what we're seeing is a trend looking in currently that we see a little bit more of that runoff over the average coming in earlier. And, you know, historically what that means then is that we're seeing the runoff come during the flood operation season more. So I think how we, you know, continue to do that today, adjust to that. And of course, how do we have to address that in the future?
Yeah. What do these findings mean for the region and the area that you oversee with the Sacramento Area Flood Control Agency?
Well, you know, right now, Sacramento, area has been doing an aggressive improvement program for flood protection. And, you know, over the last, currently in the last 20 years, you know, about $5 billion in investment has been done with federal, state, and local funds to improve the regional flood control. However, looking at the report and seeing the future climate, we can't stop on those laurels. And so we're looking at a number of other things to continue to improve flood protection in the region to address the climate uncertainty that this report highlights.
Mm. Ken, how is this shaping the conversations you're having with your colleagues at the El Dorado Water Agency?
Well, it's because, you know, our county is very diverse in itself from this the forest to the urbanized areas of El Dorado Hills. So particularly what struck my attention was the participation with the rural and rural agricultural and agricultural communities that weren't surprised with the results because they're seeing it now. They're living it now.
Yeah, they're living through it. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. They used to farm up to 3,000 feet elevation and some of the ag production. And during the last decade and a half, they've actually moved up to 3,500 feet because of the milder temperatures as they move up in the declining forest. That's the validation. That really surprised me to hear that from them of how they were changing their patterns. And so, you know, and, you know, our water purveyors in the lower areas, the urbanized areas, have already been adapting, you know, the conservation matters, the new practices, the planning for multiple dry years. So, you know, we've been preparing for this, but it is definitely a big public education piece that to make our communities understand what these changes will mean to us.
Yeah. Given that agriculture just statewide is an anchor to our economy, when you're talking to growers in your area, I mean, you just touched upon how, I mean, it's at their front door, these impacts. I guess, how could food production be impacted following this unprecedented study?
That was the first thing that crossed my mind when I saw the changes of precipitation patterns that Gary had talked about, was the farms in the Sacramento San Joaquin Valley. Because if the findings of this study with the changes of those patterns and the temperature increases of 4 to 7 degrees up in the Sierras, and the declining snowpack, that's going to be reflective up and down the Sierras that all feed into the Sacramento and San Joaquin basins, where a large part of our state and federal agricultural production occurs. So California feeds a large portion of the nation with our produce. So.
Yeah. And we just, I led with this projection or this forecast from the Greater Sacramento Economic Council that we're just going to continue to grow as we've been growing in the past 5 years. I guess, what are going to be the biggest challenges? Because that is it seems to me a lot to shoulder in terms of balancing water supply and demand in a basin that's under strain from climate change.
Well, with regards to, in terms of water supply, flood control is a little different conversation, but with water supply, the American River Basin, we have enough water contracts and water supply. It's the physical improvements, the adaptation measures. We identified six adaptation measures to start and begin physical changes to our infrastructure to be able to adapt to this climate change. And it's going to be a long 10-15 year process to get those in place.
Hmm. Well, Gary, you're with the Flood Control Agency in the Sacramento area. These warmer temperatures, and we live through this as well, it means more extreme variability of precipitation, which could increase the severity of floods coupled with drought-like conditions. I guess when it comes to these climate projections, what efforts are underway to improve flood management in the basin?
Yeah, so one of the main kind of advancements going on, not just in this region, but, you know, in the state, has been using forecasting, weather forecasting and runoff forecasts that come from the California-Nevada River Forecast Center. So there's been great advancements. And actually, this culminated when the Sacramento region just completed the new spillway at Folsom. And that spillway had is a new water control manual, and that water control manual actually takes in 5-day forecast to operate those facilities. We feel that we can continue to build on forecasting and be able to then know better when we need to release water in advance of a big event, or where we might be able to in the future be able to come and store more water based on that change in runoff that we're seeing. So we think that the ability to look at forecasting and runoff forecasting could be a great tool in the management of this basin.
Right, because given the projections from this study, I mean, it's projecting temperatures in the basin to increase by almost 5 degrees in the winter and just over 7 degrees in the summer by the end of the century. And this comes as, and you touched upon this, we can rely less and less on snowpack from 1 year to the next. So I would imagine these projections are even more instrumental and useful in managing water supply throughout the American River Basin.
That's correct. And I think it really, now we have a target. We know with these potential scenarios moving forward, how can a suite of adaptation strategies that have been developed, how can they actually help, you know, respond to that challenges in the future?
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're speaking with Gary Bardini from the Sacramento Area Flood Control Agency and Kenneth Payne from the El Dorado Water Agency about the impacts of climate change on the American River Basin. Ken, the report outlined 6 project portfolios that could address some of these issues that we're discussing. What are these portfolios and how will they address these challenges?
Well, the portfolios were developed as an integration of six strategies of how to address it. And they all have to work together. So the first one is the Sacramento Regional Groundwater Bank. That is, we have storage potential in our groundwater that's almost the size of Folsom Lake, that we can actually store water in there and take that water from Folsom Reservoir, which seems like it's the largest facility in the basin, but it's the smallest storage facility in the Central Valley Project system.
Yeah, is it about 1 million acre feet?
A million acre feet. And so we're looking at using that bank to create some space in Folsom Reservoir for the flood protection aspect. So there's another project called the River Arc Project, where we would take water from the Sacramento River and use that water instead of water from the American River to be able to offset some of the demands that accommodate growth in some of the other areas that we have. Those existing water rights are already in place. It's just access to that water now. The other project is the Alder Creek Reservoir, which would be a brand new reservoir that's been around since 1916, the thought process. And this reservoir is actually up at about 5,500 feet up near Ice House Reservoir.
And Union, there's an assortment of them at that elevation,
right?
Oh, yeah,
there's quite a few of them. And this one is actually in a really steep canyon. And so it's a convergence of these two granite formations that make it an ideal spot for a reservoir. And then we would hold that water to replace the snowpack melt in there. So, and that would accommodate give Folsom Reservoir another additional 10% capacity for flood protection and for operations to water quality concerns on preserving the salmon and the shrink salmon and the other species that we're trying to protect. And the final one is the Folsom Dam raised, combined with the groundwater banking, combined with the reservoir, would really help to provide that extra assurances we need for reservoir storage and for reclamation to maintain their operational modes that feed into the delta. So,
yeah, I'm glad you brought up runs of salmon because, you know, with water infrastructure, as we've learned over the decades and talking about a new reservoir, I mean, it can be there can be criticism and concern about what does this do to the environment and to native species. So how are you going to balance those needs?
Well, particularly with Alder Reservoir, because of the deep water configuration, there's ability to store some of that cold water pool within that reservoir. And so during those summer and late summer months, when we need those cold water shots of water into the river, where we would be able to release that water down into Folsom, and then they can subsequently release it down to the lower American downstream Folsom. So that would be the plan. That would be the next step that we would look at studying and pushing that project forward.
Gary, one of the adoption strategies mentioned in the report, and it's a mouthful, it's the Watershed Forecast Informed Reservoir Operation. Can you help us visualize what that is and what it means for people living along or benefiting from the American River Basin?
Well, yeah, so that, you know, we're kind of building on the successes of taking forecasting and the operation of Folsom and now looking upstream to existing reservoirs that are currently, these reservoirs being Hell Hole Reservoir, Union Valley, and French Meadows. And we think by making additional modifications like we did at Folsom, at those facilities, and then linking all of these reservoirs together as a single, would then give us much greater flexibility in the region to some of the challenges outlined in the report. One last thing that we're trying to go further, though, is, again, that will improve management of reservoir surface water management, but to link that into groundwater management in a much more integrated way into the future, we think is also a critical element of it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the study is unique in that it's a collaboration between, you know, various agencies involved in water management. I would imagine, you know, Gary, you're with the Sacramento Area Flood Control Agency. Ken, you're with the El Dorado Water Agency. You two are talking regularly because, as we said, it's interconnected.
Oh, very, very much. Well, and that's where the non-federal partners, the Placer County Water Agency, El Dorado, the cities of Sacramento, Roseville, Folsom. And then we also included this regional water authority, which includes 20-something water purveyors within the region. So this planning and this communication had to be integrated. And the study, you know, in the past, we used to do studies independently, all our agencies. But this collaboration is, it's at a level that we really need to work together on this.
Earlier this month, given that Northern California experienced record-setting temperatures in the midst of drought, you know, I go back to a conversation I had yesterday, and this was with a wildfire ecologist. And essentially what they said was, you know, it's becoming less and less predictable, you know, even despite all the research and experience, you know, because we continue to set new records. And I understand wildfires are one component, but this is all connected to climate change. How does that strain finding the right solutions for the future that's decades away, and we don't necessarily know what that picture exactly is going to look like? Ken, I'll start with you.
Well, it really, because we start with a study on looking at the moisture content and the climate change within the watershed basin itself, and then it extends into some of the work that El Dorado Water Agency and the entities were working with the forest management, Department of Forestry, working with the regional resource conservation districts on some of the forest management activities and clearings that we're working on now. We're still working on the Calder fire cleanup right now. And, you know, the mosquito fire wasn't expected either. And so that's, you know, managing those resources. But there's this integration of all of our resources that we have never seen before on putting together these resources and planning activities to address forest management, urbanization of the barriers between urbanization and then water supply, on how to move around to create snow pillows or other areas, opportunities that we have that can supplement some of the findings of this American River Basin study.
Gary, how does that shape the Sacramento Area Flood Control Agency?
Well, I think we're, you know, the interagency planning and collaboration is essential. And I think the kind of efforts needed moving forward are more system-wide along the lines we just discussed. So it's extremely important that all agencies are working together, and there's no silver bullet. We will need every bullet we can generate to address the challenges moving forward.
Finally, what do you want listeners to take away from this conversation in a way where, on an individual level, we can better prepare and plan for the future? Gary, I'll start with you.
Well, I think, you know, there's a number of efforts going on. I think looking at further investments in funding from the federal and state government to implement many of our actions are going to be critical. And then, as I described, the ability of the agencies working together and bringing projects to readiness will be critical.
How about you, Ken?
Well, for the communities that we work with, that we serve, a lot of that is reaching out to them to understand some of these changes are actually occurring and how we're going to have to adapt as communities, integrated communities, for managing water, protecting our forests, and also lobbying our representatives on state and levels to continue funding these programs. It's going to be necessary. None of them are small. So
yeah, and adapting as we grow, right?
Exactly. Yes.
Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you, Vic.
Thank you.
Gary Bardini is Director of Planning with the Sacramento Area Flood Control Agency, and Kenneth Payne is General Manager of the El Dorado Water Agency, discussing the impact of climate change on the American River Basin. Still ahead, a retired University of the Pacific professor wrote a book about renowned American jazz pianist and composer Dave Brubeck, telling the social justice backstory of The Real Ambassadors, a musical which premiered 60 years ago this month. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. We'll be right back.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Dave Brubeck, he's a famous American jazz pianist and composer. But did you know he is much more than a jazz icon? He also composed classical music, choral works, and a ballet. He even wrote a Broadway-style musical in collaboration with his wife, Lola. That musical, The Real Ambassadors, starring Louis Armstrong, is the subject of a new book by retired UOP professor Keith Hatschek. It tells the social justice backstory of the Brubeck's magnum opus, which premiered at the Monterey Jazz Festival 60 years ago this month. Cap Radio jazz host Avery Jeffrey has more.
The title The Real Ambassadors is an ironic reference to the U.S. State Department program that sent jazz musicians around the world as cultural ambassadors. With music by Dave and words by Iola Brubeck, the musical exposes the hypocrisy of the U.S. government, which was using jazz musicians to promote democracy and freedom abroad while maintaining policies of racial inequality at home.
Who's the real ambassador? Certain facts we can't ignore. In my humble way, I'm the USA. Though I represent the government don't represent some policies I'm for. Oh, we learn to be concerned about the constitutionality in our nation. Segregation isn't a legality. Soon our only differences will be in personality. That's what I stand for. Who's the real ambassador? Yes. The real ambassador.
In his humble way, he's the USA.
This studio recording of The Real Ambassadors featuring Louis Armstrong was made just before the musical premiered at the 1962 Monterey Jazz Festival. We're lucky to have it because The Real Ambassadors was only performed once with its original cast, and the performance wasn't captured on tape. By all accounts, that September night in Monterey was magical and meaningful.
When Armstrong came on stage that night, he was dressed up as an ambassador with a top hat and a tuxedo, and he walked at center stage and beamed at the audience. There was a standing ovation after a huge roar came out from the crowd to see Armstrong on stage playing a role, a dramatic role, that directly matched his own strong feelings about Jim Crow and how segregation was a blight on America.
Keith Hatschek has authored several books on the music industry and was the director of the Music Management Program at the University of the Pacific for 20 years. Until recently, UOP housed the Brubeck Collection, a massive archive detailing the careers of Pacific alums Dave and Iola Brubeck. When Hatschek discovered materials related to The Real Ambassadors in the archives, he was surprised.
I knew most of Dave Brubeck's albums, and I thought, he never did a Broadway musical. What was this? So as I dug deeper and deeper in the Brubeck collection, I found three or four big file folders just full of correspondence and clippings. And then in another part of the collection, sheet music scores, song sketches, lyric sheets. And I realized this was a huge project between 1957 and 1962 that Dave and his wife, Iola Brubeck, really invested a lot of time and a lot of heart into.
Hatschek says the reason The Real Ambassadors was so important to the Brubecks was because it wasn't just a musical, it was a statement. They wanted to expose the racist ways that were ingrained in America and sanctioned by the government.
Dave and Iola decided to use their voice at that time, as Dave's star was really ascending, to call out segregation and to argue that it was pretty absurd to determine on someone's skin color how smart or successful or talented they might be. But that was the way America worked. And Dave led an integrated band, and there were hundreds of nights they played when they had trouble getting a hotel room after their gig because Eugene Wright, their wonderful bassist, was African American.
One experience that put the issues of segregation and government hypocrisy into stark relief for Brubeck was his involvement in a cultural exchange program hosted by the U.S. State Department. Louis Armstrong also took part in the program, which is what gave Dave and Iola the idea for creating the Real Ambassadors in the late 1950s.
American jazz musicians were touring all over the world on behalf of Uncle Sam and winning the hearts and minds, you might say, of people from India to Pakistan. Well, when these musicians got home, many of whom were African Americans, the minute they got off the airplane, it was back to, here's your water fountain, here's your hotel room, and you could only get food through the back of the restaurant. So that irony was not lost on Dave and Iola Brubeck. And when Dave pitched the concept for the musical to Lewis, he flipped. He said, this is just what I wanted to say artistically. These are the thoughts I've had that segregation is ridiculous. And I'd love to play the lead role in your musical, Dave.
The State Department has discovered jazz. It reaches folks like nothing ever has. Like when they feel that jazzy rhythm, they know we're really with them. That's what we call cultural exchange.
Despite Armstrong's enthusiasm, the Brubeck's Dream Project faced some major challenges, not the least of which was the popularity of its star performers.
Brubeck was on top of the world, leading the top small jazz combo, touring America, Europe, all over, and he was booked months in advance. Armstrong, of course, was booked for movies, television, film appearances, tours up to 2 years in advance. So the economics of actually staging the musical as a musical with costumes and dancers and a chorus didn't really make any sense. Their careers would have all had to been put on hold.
When Broadway didn't work out, they tried for London and Washington, D.C., but to no avail. Ultimately, the Real Ambassadors, starring Louis Armstrong, Dave Brubeck, Carmen McRae, and Lambert Hendrickson Bavon, found a home in Dave's native California as a one-off at the Monterey Jazz Festival in 1962.
The co-founders of that festival, Jimmy Lyons, a jazz DJ, and Ralph J. Gleason, who was a jazz journalist, wanted to premiere new jazz music that had been created just for the Monterey Jazz Festival every year. So premiering a musical, even in a concert version, fit right in with what their raison d'etre was for the festival. And Jimmy Lyons had to finesse the booking agents to get all of the talent, because we're not only talking about Louis Armstrong, we're talking about Carmen McRae, Lambert Hendrickson Bavon, Dave Brubeck's band, minus Paul Desmond, who didn't want to participate, and Louis's six-piece band. So Jimmy had the wherewithal to get all those artists booked for their own sets, and then he added a sentence in the end of each booking agreement, plus play 1 hour on Sunday night between 9 and midnight. And he did not specify what that 1 hour would be. Well, it was, in fact, the Real Ambassadors. And when it premiered that night, Avery, that crowd couldn't really believe what they were hearing and seeing. Here was Louis Armstrong and his band playing with Dave Brubeck, who on paper, they played completely different styles of jazz music. And Brubeck with lyrics and music, what? But the audience fell right in from the first beat of the first song, Everybody's Coming. And when Armstrong came on stage that night, Dave recalled, it sounded like an explosion.
Everybody's coming.
Yeah, yeah.
Everybody's coming.
Yeah, yeah.
Everybody's coming here. Louis Armstrong will appear. Promise, promise, she will sing.
Everybody's coming.
Everybody's coming.
Yeah, yeah.
Louis is a coming, coming is a coming. Rubik is a coming. Lambert is a coming. Everybody's coming. The process is coming.
Like most any musical, The Real Ambassadors features a mix of up-tempo numbers and love songs as it delivers its rebuke of segregation. While the message alone proved to be apropos to the moment when the civil rights struggle in America was nearing its apex, the music and Armstrong's poignant performance stirred emotions in the audience and praise from the critics.
God created man in his image and likeness.
They said I look like God.
In the image of God created he man.
Could God be black? My God,
in the image of God created man.
If I'm a man in the image of thee,
male and female created man.
Could thou perchance a zebra be?
In the image and likeness of God,
can it be?
The Monterey premiere was truly a night to remember, but the musical might well have been forgotten if Columbia hadn't reissued the studio recording of The Real Ambassadors on CD. Hatschek says it brought Brubeck and Armstrong's message to a whole new audience.
This became sort of a footnote in both of their careers until, as you said, in 1994, Columbia reissued the CD, and a lot of younger musicians picked up on it and went, "What's this? Hey, this is pretty cool."
Three of those younger musicians, vocalist Liz Wright, trumpeter Roy Hargrove, and bassist Christian McBride, joined Dave Brubeck on stage at the 2002 Monterey Jazz Festival to celebrate the 40th anniversary of The Real Ambassadors. Still, the show never made it to Broadway as the Brubecks had first dreamed.
In 2002, they did three or four songs from it at the Monterey Jazz Festival, got a very, very warm response. But again, it never really got out to the broader public, which I think was a disappointment to them because they saw Armstrong as the most eloquent spokesperson for equal rights. And my last in-person interview in 2009, they were both very clear that for them, The Real Ambassadors just fueled them to want to do even more and produce more new works and more different approaches musically to talk about social justice issues.
As we approach the 60th anniversary of the musical's premiere at Monterey, Keith Hatschek says it's important to remember that advocating for what's right is just as important today as it was in 1962. And doing so doesn't require star power.
Every one of us has agency. And although at the time Dave Brubeck and Louis Armstrong were world-renowned performers, they would have tackled a project like this even if they were just local heroes because it was in their DNA. They wanted to use their artistic voices to speak out. My challenge to people is that it doesn't have to be racial issues. It could be the environment. It could be healthcare. It could be how our society values elderly folks. Whatever your thing is, be a champion for that.
For Insight, I'm Avery Jeffrey.
Remember who you are and what you represent. Always be a credit to your government. No matter what you say or what you do, the eyes of the world are watching you. Remember who you are and what you represent. Represent, represent, represent.
And that is Avery Jeffrey's interview with Keith Hatschek, a retired University of the Pacific professor who authored a new book about The Real Ambassadors, a musical by the Brubecks, which tells the social justice backstory of the Brubecks' magnum opus, which premiered at the Monterey Jazz Festival 60 years ago this month. Author Hatschek will sign copies of his new book about The Real Ambassadors on Sunday, October 9th at 2 p.m. at the Avid Reader on Broadway in Sacramento. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to join the conversation, email us, insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producers Nick Dobis and Victor Corral Martinez, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Chris Feltz. Joe Barr is CAP Radio's chief content officer. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great first day of fall and an awesome weekend. We'll catch you back here on Monday. In the meantime, here is more of You Swing Baby, a duet between Louis Armstrong and Carmen McRae.
All men seem square.
Stay gone. People ask me what I'm on.
To quote a phrase from old Satchmo, if you got to ask, you'll never know.
I'm on love. You swing, baby, you swing for me. I vote you soulmate of the century.
Alone I sing a melody,
but it takes two for harmony.
Singing, swinging, a life's complete. As long as you're in rhythm with the cosmic beat. Living, loving the human race. This mess that's crazy makes the world swing in place.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.